if it works, it works, you know.
I'm sorry, to make sure what happens?
To make sure that it's available to anybody who wants to hear it.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay, so any LP member who wants to listen to it,
sure,
will be able to do so. And
sure,
if they want a copy sent to them, they can get that at the cost of whatever medium it's put on.
I don't know what the details are, but it'll be available one way or another.
I think you can go. Oh, is there any problem with what I just said? I'd just like to get this down for the record.
I don't know how difficult it is to record this, or what's the best way of distributing it. Maybe the best way is to try and make a recording that we can post on the website or something. I don't know, but one way or another, if it successfully records, we'll make sure that it's available to anybody who wants to hear it. Okay.
Who's going to make a transcript of it?
I don't know about a transcript.
Okay, just as a file that they can listen to.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it would be okay if Star Trek out.
Excuse me. Let me just see if Bob, are you there?
Oh yeah. I just came on.
Okay, Bob.
All right.
Hey guys, Rodney. This is Mark Hinkle. Would you please be the traffic cop? And if somebody wants to speak, say, Rodney, may I speak? And because otherwise, this is going to go on for days.
I'm muting myself. Goodbye.
Okay. Thank you. Let's get the teleconference started, please. Thank you all for coming. Just to review a few small housework details. We'll start off with Mark Sells' testimony. I have 7:13 right now on my atomic clock. At 8:13, if it lasts that long, we will end Mark's testimony. It doesn't mean that we have to go to 8:13, but we won't go any further than that. Then a 10-minute break, and then we will entertain Dan's testimony at 8:23.
Rodney, this is Star Chop.
Yes.
One more just housekeeping point about the recording. I mentioned this in the message earlier today as well. I think that immediately after this, whoever is present at the office where it's being recorded should check the recording and verify that it came out okay.
Okay.
And post something to that effect.
Okay.
So that we don't, potentially run into a situation later where someone says, well, this part got jumbled or anything like that.
Okay.
Or if that's the case, we know it right away that part is not acceptable.
Okay. We will try to get it arranged so everybody can hear. We need to get going. Anyone that's listening that's not either on the Judiciary Committee or one of the two parties, Mark Sells or Dan Wiener, we request that they mute their phone by pressing *6 to cut out any extraneous noise. And I'll repeat that periodically as we go on. We will hear 10 minutes of Mark's testimony unimpeded. After that, then I will go around the Judiciary Committee and allow them to ask questions until we either run out of questions or the time is 8:13. Is there any questions from anybody? Okay. Mark Sells, you have the floor.
Okay, I guess I will just take some time to go over some of the arguments that I have made regarding the...
Can everybody hear Mark?
Yes.
Okay.
I just sent another amendment to my complaint as well regarding Robert's Rules of Orders 10th edition. And... now, I did send it to the Judicial Committee list, and unfortunately it didn't. I don't know if you've all got it, but Dale did get it. Maybe she can forward it to the other members. But the Robert's Rules of Order 10th edition, which has jurisdiction over all issues not enumerated in the bylaws, Bylaw 26, and it also has jurisdiction over all procedural issues not covered under the convention rules, and that's in Rule 1 of the convention rules. Robert's Rules of 10th Edition, Chapter 18, Section 56, content of the bylaws, Article 3, page 555, line 2 states, members cannot be assessed any additional payment aside from their dues unless it is provided in the bylaws, and there's no additional payments required for delegates provided under the bylaws. So it doesn't say, it says here payment, that's a very broad definition, and should cover, you know, the fees for being in the location of the convention, which are very high. So now there was an assertion made that a person could drive down through Mexico and get on the boat, but I don't see how a person is going to be able to do that unless they, again, pay another kind of fee to get on the boat. Now, there are Robert's Rules of Order does apply, and this is also, besides that, it's an excessive fee to go on this cruise. It appears to be, when adding everything up, over $300. Now, this is in addition to the normal costs of travel. The other people have argued, some people have argued that, you know, there's always costs to going to a convention, and there always is. However, this is an additional cost besides that. You're required, in essence, to buy meals because it's part of the package that you have to buy to go on the boat. And at no convention have we ever required people to buy meals to go to the convention or vote at the convention. As well, the next point,
well, Mark, if I can interrupt you, saying, what bylaw did you say that is?
What bylaw? This is Robert's Rules of Order.
Oh, Robert, I'm sorry. Okay.
That's Robert's Rules of Order. Now I wanted to go to the bylaw concerning I wanted to go to the bylaw. I mean, I assume you've all read my complaint. I wanted to go to the bylaw requiring that the convention be bylaw 3, scope. The party shall conduct its activities primarily in the state of California. Any party activities taking place outside of California must be coordinated with, approved by state or national Libertarian Party organizations having jurisdiction over the areas affected. So it will be conducted basically in Mexico, since we will be docked in Mexico, as I'm understanding. There is the Libertarian Party of the National Libertarian Party does not have jurisdiction in Mexico. So we would be in violation of both of these requirements. The party shall conduct its activities primarily within the state of California. In violation of that, because it's not, I mean, it's definitely one of our primary activities to the convention. And one could also make the argument that basically the corporation or the entity known as the LPC is only in operation during the convention, because only then can business be conducted for the party. The officers can be elected. So it would definitely be and the bylaws of the party, the rules of the party can be amended there, and only there. So that would definitely, I would make the argument that this is definitely referring to the convention. And any party activities taking place outside of California must be coordinated with and approved by the state or national Libertarian Party organizations having jurisdiction over the areas affected. Now, this was written probably assuming that no one would ever have a convention outside of the United States. So not only is it impossible to coordinate with the national party, But the party, if it existed, would have the party having jurisdiction in that area, which would be the Libertarian Party of Mexico, which, as far as I know, does not exist. So I mean, it's just not even covered at all. Also, the county bylaws also state that the county convention must be held in a place that is accessible and centrally located. Now, this is all what bylaws these are in are put down in my written complaint.
Bylaws, section 3.
And what that states is that it has to be centrally located. Now, there has to be a consistency between the bylaws of the counties and the bylaws of the state. There needs to be, there's a precedent for that. It's what is required, as far as I can tell, also by Robert's Rules of Order. And if we were to somehow interpret the rules of the state being in deviation of that, that would probably violate our own bylaws, because the bylaws of the counties cannot be, as far as I know, in collusion with the bylaws of the state. And they are written very similarly, and I would certainly say that in order for us to be consistent, which I think is required both by precedent, by Robert's Rules of Order, and by our own other sections of our own bylaws, that we need to be consistent with the counties. And this convention is not accessible. It is imposing additional fees and imposing additional restrictions upon the delegates. Now, there's nowhere in our bylaws or in Robert's Rules of Order that allow an executive committee to place additional restrictions on a delegate. And I think this is what this does. This is what this does do. One of the things that it does is it says it puts a restriction that you must pay this $300, which, or whatever costs are taken. You must buy meals, in a sense. You must purchase a room. Also, what it's saying is you must arrive on Friday before the boat leaves. And then I believe the attorney says it leaves on Friday or Saturday or Saturday morning, and then you must stay till the end of the convention. And these are additional regulations put on the delegates. The executive committee doesn't have the power to do. Those kinds of things would have to be put into the bylaws. And those things wouldn't be. Those things, I doubt anyone could say reasonably, if proposed on the floor, would be accepted, that a delegate must buy meals, a delegate must purchase a room at the place. Also, it asks delegates to leave if it is true, indeed, that a person could drive down through Mexico and get on the boat to vote without paying those fees. The additional requirement that you must leave the country is also something that is unreasonable and is a requirement that could not be put on our delegates. Also, it also restricts delegates. Some people are claustrophobic. Some people have places that they need to go. Some people have jobs. They need to work. So you're holding things on a work day. Also, other people have seasickness as well. And some people have medical conditions and may not wish to be in the boat at sea. So there's various problems here. And that I'm trying to summarize some of them, but if you have looked carefully over my complaint, you will see many more reasons. But I've been given only a certain amount of time. Also, somebody said that we did hold the convention in Las Vegas once, and that was outside California, but that was before the bylaw saying that was done before the bylaw was in place. stating that we must conduct our affairs mainly inside of California. And even if it wasn't, just because someone's violated a bylaw in the past doesn't give us the right to violate them now.
Okay.
So that's basically it.
Okay. Well, thank you. You'll probably still have chances to elaborate on points as the questions come up. Let's start with arbitrarily. Let's start with Gail.
Pardon?
You have the floor for asking questions to Mark.
I don't have any questions, and I don't know if you heard me when I said that Bylaw 6, County Organization, Section 4 about accessibility was put in place in 1989. It's not in the 1988 copy of the bylaws, and it was 1988 when we met in Las Vegas. But other than that, I don't have any specific questions.
Okay. Mark Hinkle?
Okay. Mark, when you talked about consistency between the LPC and the county parties, I am a little puzzled at that. I know the county parties, I mean, they can't counteract the bylaws, but why do you think that since the county parties are basically creatures of the state party, why do you think it flows equally both ways?
It does. I mean, we need to have an organization. We need to be consistent. I mean, you have
Okay, but Mark, the LPC of Santa Clara County only has one vice chair. The LPC has two vice chairs. So is the county party in violation of being inconsistent with the LPC?
I would say no, because it has been... it has been split between, you know, just taking something and splitting it in that way doesn't...
Doesn't our bylaws stipulate that there has to be a chair and then I think a secretary and or a treasurer, and the LPC doesn't even specify that there has to be any other officers?
Well, I think that would be an issue that would be separate as far as something that has to do with conventions. As there's nothing stipulated in those laws about who has to be present at the convention, as far as I can tell. So what I'm doing is I'm looking for the Bylaw 8, Section 4, let me read part of my complaint. If the bylaws should be applied with consistency, then the rules of means for county organization is stated in Bylaw 8, Section 4, that are not in conflict with any other bylaw or rule pertaining to state conventions, must also be applied to them. This bylaw section states such notice of election shall specify the reason for the meeting and the time and place reasonably accessible to its membership. The judicial committee can invalidate a county organization's meeting, and also that the same is true for meetings of a state organization. If you have jurisdiction over one and the other, that also implies that you have that the rules need to be consistent.
I don't follow that, but okay. And regarding statement about the business being primarily within California, I mean, you do understand that primarily doesn't mean exclusively.
Right, but I mean, certainly what would you consider the convention to be? I mean, would you consider it to be 10% of the convention, 20% of the convention, 30% of the convention. Let me,
wait.
I mean, 30% of the business is done there. I mean, what would you consider the convention to be? The yearly convention is really the only time that we're really in session, because only then do you have a quorum. So primarily inside of California, I mean, it's a pretty huge chunk. You know, I would consider it more than that to be, you know, 50%. We have four meetings a year of the executive committee, and we have one meeting of the party itself. So, I mean, it definitely, primarily, if you eliminate the convention from that bylaw, I mean, you're eliminating a pretty huge chunk of it. I would certainly interpret the convention to be one of the primary activities, or 40, 50, 60, 70% of the activities of the party in that, under that bylaw. So, I mean, primarily inside of California. That means definitely the convention, which is the main meeting of the party for that year, and the only time that the bylaws can be amended.
Well, certainly, but, okay, that's a non sequitur to me, but okay.
What do you mean it's a non sequitur to you?
Well, you elucidated or clarified what you meant by the party business. I just had a different definition of what party business meant. I mean,
yeah.
To me, it's every volunteer working at the local level. It's our executive director, it's our officers, teleconferencing every 2 weeks. I mean, all that.
Well, but I think affairs of the party is not referring to the daily activity of its members. It's just the affairs of the party itself is referring to the inner workings of the party, its executive committee, and its conventions. I wouldn't even say that this bylaw in any way covers, you know, an activist going down to the, corner and, you know, yelling down with the state or whatever it is that activists do. I wouldn't even say that this is in any way referring to that, because the bylaws traditionally do not refer to the activities of its members. It refers to the what this governs, and what the bylaws govern is the activities of the judicial committee, and they generally do not refer or put any kind of restriction. I mean, they were to the executive committee, the judicial committee, the convention. That's what they cover. Like any constitution, they cover what the governing body and governing members and officers of that government or body or political party do. They don't refer at all to our person, what they do. So what the bylaws are referring to is what its officers are doing and what its committees are doing. So it's definitely the scope of that bylaw is what we're doing. The four meetings that the executive committee has a year, and the convention. That's what it's referring to, and that's what they're the rules for. They're not rules for members. I don't know any part of the bylaw that has a rule for a member. A member can't do this, a member can't do that. It talks about delegates. It talks about the executive committee. It talks about the meetings of the executive committee, and it talks about the rules for the convention. And that's it. So I would definitely say when it says that, it refers to those things, primary activities and those activities alone. If you were to, it doesn't include all these other workings, nor does it even mention the executive director. I don't think there's anywhere inside of the bylaws that the executive director is mentioned, or his activities, or the daily activities of the members. What these are rules pertaining to our meetings, which means the four executive committee meetings and our convention.
Okay, well, I would direct you to bylaws 5 under membership, because there are plenty of things that the memberships can and cannot do based on our bylaws.
Well, they're that's tiny.
So, all right. if you have other...
Certainly not the main thrust of the bylaws is what the members can and cannot do. The main thrust is that.
Okay. Mark Hinkle, if you have any other questions,
Not at this time.
Excuse me?
Not at this time.
Not at this time.
Okay. We'll get back to you if you have more questions. Starchild.
Yes, and just a procedural question first, Rodney. Are we each, I thought we were each asking one question, but was that changed, or?
I didn't necessarily designate how many questions.
Okay.
Just a recap.
I have
5 minutes or so.
That's three things here I was going to ask, actually at least three, but I can wait if we want to keep going around. So the first question I have for you, Mark, is does Robert's Rules of Order, that you're aware of, say anything about that an organization must hold the convention within the jurisdiction of an organization, or that holding it outside this jurisdiction would constitute an additional requirement?
I believe there is something in Robert's Rules of Order. However, I do not know specifically where that is. But my belief is that it does, and I did ask a point of inquiry in my amended complaint about that to the Judicial Committee. I don't know whether or not that would be ruled in order by the chair, but there are parliamentarians capable parliamentarian, or maybe more, on the Judicial Committee, as far as I am aware.
That you asked what of the chair? I'm not quite following you.
Well, at the end of the amended complaint, I put a point of inquiry. I'm not sure procedurally whether or not that is in order, and that may take a ruling of the chair, but the last it states in the fourth, number four, my last point is a point of inquiry to the Judicial Committee. Does not Robert's Rules of Order prohibit a committee from restricting the members' access to a vote by location or any other means? Now, that would probably take a ruling of the chair to understand whether or not that putting a point of information in a complaint is in order. I do not know.
Yeah, I guess just trying to find out whether you'd gotten an answer to that question, if you had any further information on that.
I don't. The amount of research I've done, I did, however, find the other stipulations that I was referring to before in Robert's Rule of Order about fees.
Okay. My next question is regarding fees. Is it your view that any fee required to be an LPC delegate would be against the bylaws and or against Robert's Rules of Order, or that only an excessive fee would be against either or both of those documents?
I would say that any fee above and beyond the membership dues would be excessive, and certainly the national party, which we need to be in coordination with for our convention, has stated that you do not need now to pay membership fee to be a member of the national party. And again, I would ask for consistency there as well. So if you took that view, then certainly no fee should be required. I think in California we can require a membership fee, and I would certainly think that there's an membership fee of joining the organization. I think
that would be dues, correct?
What?
That would be dues, correct?
That would be dues. Anything beyond the dues, I think, is definitely against not only the laws in the state of California, it's stipulated against in Robert's Rules of Order and our own bylaws.
How would it be a violation of California state law?
Well, there is the rules from the Peace and Freedom Party, which we have adopted and apply to us. There is an argument that they do not apply in some way, but we have basically adopted them, whether they apply or not, on our formation. These are what govern us. We haven't made any kind of a ruling from inside of our organization saying that they somehow now do not apply. Because our organization was formed, our organization was allowed to form only after those laws were passed, as far as I know.
That's fine. I do remember your argument about the Peace and Freedom thing, and I saw that. So I was just wondering if there's anything else that had, you might be referring to. I'll continue.
Let me answer that. Let me add to the answering of that question that I have not received any kind of word from the Secretary of State whether or not this is legal. She may have a problem as well with it. Their state law. She may find something in state law. Also, fundraising outside of in foreign countries for a political party of the United States may also be illegal as well.
That's an interesting point. Is there anything, in your opinion, that would legally, either in the bylaws, again, Robert's Rules of Order or state law or other documents, prevent the party from paying for delegates to anyone, any member who, you know, wished to be a delegate and was approved by the normal procedures for becoming a delegate, for paying their cost to go on the cruise and then asking delegates to voluntarily donate money to cover that cost?
It seems that that would be a way of granting access to everyone in order to comply with Robert's Rules of Order, state law, and our own bylaws.
Okay.
If applied consistently.
And my final question is, looking at the minutes and from the XCOM meeting where they talked about the contract and from a point that was brought up earlier, it's been noted that there was nothing raised at that time about the bylaws. I'm just wondering what your thought process was, or at what point you decided to bring this to the committee, and why it wasn't raised during the discussion of the contract.
I brought some of these up then. I thought it was an outrageous idea. It's unprecedented in the history of political parties, as far as I know. I think that if this was attempted by the Republicans or the Democrats, that it would definitely go to court and it would be ruled to be illegal. In fact, I think it is illegal because of the fundraising aspect of conventions, certainly under the new BCRA rules. And I think that we may be we're putting ourselves in a lot of hot water here. It's a scary thing for me to come back, have one of our rivals decide that they've heard about our yacht convention and that they are going to make a complaint to the Secretary of State, and then we'll have our...
Did you raise any legal questions or mention legal concerns during that meeting?
I did. As far as I know, I did raise it. I thought that this could have many legal problems. My main complaint, though, was for accessibility to the members. I believe that we're a political party, and we should be encouraging as many people as possible to be involved with us, because our desire is, of course, to get as many votes as possible. We're a political party. We have to get voted. You know, we depend on votes. We depend on participation for the larger number of people. That is the whole idea of politics, is to get the most amount of people to vote for you and participate and give money. Then
I'm sorry if I can interject. It's kind of getting away from, you know, what I was asking about. If you don't mind, I'll just cut that
short. The bylaws. Conflict with the bylaws.
Oh, did I bring up that it conflicted with the bylaws? I believe that I did, although I didn't have the specific section in front of me. I did remember reading something in the bylaws that would make such a thing impossible. I did not have it with me. I did not think this would pass. I thought it was too much of an outrageous idea to go anywhere. I was very surprised.
Did the chair or did any other members of the XCOM address any of the legal points that were raised?
No, we didn't.
They did not offer an opinion that it was legal or anything to that effect?
We didn't have time to prepare, but there were some concerns voiced by me and I believe two other people there on the executive committee.
Okay. Again, we'll get back to you, StarCraft. We have, if you have other questions.
Okay. That was my last question anyway, so go ahead.
Okay. Thanks. Bob?
Bob here. Mark, it's always been...
Before you go on, Bob, I just wanted to remind, I hear a lot of beats. That means people are coming on. I just want to remind those people
or
yeah, like that.
No, it requests that you mute your phone by dialing *6 to help out with our background noise. I appreciate that. Thank you. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. Mark, it's always been my interpretation, I guess you'd call it, of the bylaws regarding activities outside the state that it was referring to things, for example, the activities that the National Party did a couple years ago in working against the Know Your Customer bank rule that the party fought against, and that it didn't really refer to things like conventions, or for example, to take a hypothetical, say that the Connecticut State Party wanted to have something regarding eminent domain and wanted to argue against the Kelo decision that the California State Party could work with the Connecticut Party on that, but that the California State Party wasn't supposed to, say, get directly involved in some kind of issue in Connecticut.
I think it probably...
Can you address that?
Yeah, as I was addressing before, the rules, generally, the bylaws, when you look at them, generally are talking about and referring to things that the Judicial Committee, I mean, the Executive Committee can and cannot do, the governing officers of the committee can and cannot do. It wouldn't occur to that interpretation, you know, has even occurred to me, and I don't think it's occurred to too many other people.
Well,
it may be that it applies to both. But it certainly, the scope of it, I think that the scope of it could be interpreted that it could also apply to that, but I think that reading the rest of the bylaws, it refers to the workings of the executives and executive committees and conventions, that generally it's talking about not what the membership does, but what the officers can and cannot do.
The campaign against the Know Your Customer rule was launched by the National Committee of the LP, and
right.
And was coordinated through that. And I was certainly it doesn't. I would agree that the bylaws don't cover what sorts of. Campaigns regarding this or that initiative or something against this or that law that members can engage in. It's talking about things that the executive committee can do. The other thing I wanted to ask you was that when with regards to fundraising outside. Outside the country is I've always thought that was talking about fundraising from people who are not U.S. citizens or from organizations that are not U.S. citizens. It doesn't apply to asking for U.S. citizens or residents of the state of California for money when they happen to be outside the state. Could you address that?
Well, I do not have it, but this is one of my fears with this proposed convention. Not only the accessibility, the fees being imposed, being against California state law and the bylaws and Robert's Rules of Order, but also that there could be other complications outside of that with BCRA, because I simply do not know what additional laws have been put into place, and I have not been able to find out, because I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know but I've researched everything as much as I can. And this is, again, just one of my fears. You know, I'm worried that when we're out there, we're going to be doing something illegal. And I don't think that it would be tried by the Republicans or the Democrats. I don't think that they go to Mexico and have meetings in Mexico and do fundraising from American citizens or anyone else. It just doesn't seem like it would be legal. And I would definitely say we may have a problem. There's so many things here that since this is unprecedented, that we don't know. We're basically taking a huge jump off of a cliff and saying, I hope everything works out okay. And, you know, the more I look into this, the more I find things that are wrong with it and possibly illegal. So I worry about it. As an officer of this party, I don't want us to have problems. I don't want us to have problems coming back out of court and having other people hear about it and cause problems for us.
Any more questions, Bob?
The fear of the unknown.
No more questions at this time.
Okay, we'll probably get around. We'll probably be able to make one more pass around. We've got about 18-20 minutes left. I have three or four questions. I will ask two of them and then allow other people to ask a second question or another round of questions. Mark, you talked about reasonable accommodations, and you talked about additional requirements. I wrote down reasonable accommodations. You talked about additional requirements for being able to be a delegate and participate, and you mentioned things like claustrophobia. Getting in and out of Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. I'm kind of wondering what do you think is a reasonable requirement, additional requirement, and what is not? I'm a little confused what your philosophy is about that.
Well, it's not necessarily the philosophy. It's what's in the rules. So it's stated, specifically that in three different places, as far as I can see, that it has to be accessible to the membership. And, the membership, when you say membership, that implies, okay, the membership fee, the people that are members, the people who have signed the pledge and paid the dues, okay, because it's reasonable, accessible to membership. When you go to the county bylaws, which we need to apply consistently, we need to they need to be consistent with the state bylaws. It says that it needs to be reasonably accessible to the membership. So when you say membership, that means the $25 fee and signing the pledge. Beyond that is unreasonable.
Mark, let me ask you a question. If a person lives in Siskiyou and the conference and the convention is in San Diego, is that against the bylaws? Is that an additional requirement?
No, it's not, because the applying the consistency with the county bylaws says that it needs to be held within the county. Now, certainly the state, as the bylaws do state, needs to be held. The affairs need to be conducted primarily within the state of California. So,
I'm asking you about additional requirements.
Well, that wouldn't be...
I mean, to be a delegate.
To be a delegate.
Yes.
I think that asking a person to arrive at a certain time before the business meeting, to go to a foreign country to go to a business meeting, to pay a fee of over $300 to go to a convention, these are things that are clearly wrong. These are additional requirements not stipulated or permitted in our bylaws. And they can't be done because the executive committee can't go and say, well, we're going to put these additional requirements on a delegate. They cannot do that. There's no authority to do that.
Okay, I understand that, and I would agree with that. But what I'm asking about is what I'm trying to get a hold of is what you think is a reasonable, what you think is an additional requirement. Are you saying that if there's any person who is claustrophobic, or if there's any person who works on a Saturday that cannot make the convention, that the executive committee is violating the bylaw by scheduling a convention in such a way that it inconveniences any member?
No, I wouldn't say any one member.
Reasonable.
Yeah, I wouldn't say any one member, but I would say there could be a large number. I would say, firstly, there are many reasons about what is reasonably accessible. Certainly, there are going to be people that, you know, can't leave their home, you know, and if you're holding it in a hotel, you know, that doesn't, you have to decide, you know, what is reasonable. And I think that holding it on a boat and requiring the person stay for 3 days or go to a foreign country is unreasonable. But certainly, some people aren't going to be able to attend because they're sick or they're ill or something like that. That would be an unreasonable requirement. I don't think that would meet that threshold at all. I mean, certainly if you're claustrophobic and you're holding it in a convention, you know, I'm a pretty claustrophobic person myself. And during executive committee meetings, you will often see me leave the room and go outside because I do have problems staying in a...
When no. You're inconvenienced like that?
No, it does not. That wouldn't be unreasonable for me. I mean, certainly if I'm claustrophobic, I could go out and walk on the deck, and that may help. But I'm just bringing up additional points that these kind of small aggravations that it would be unreasonable to bring up for a convention on land are then become exacerbated as well as the other problems that I've stated, which are more extreme and I think do go beyond reasonably accessible. Asking a delegate to leave this country and go to a foreign country, asking a delegate to arrive and attend, you know, 3 days in order to vote, which is not required any other time. I think that that's where it becomes unreasonable, and it does exacerbate other things that generally occur, you know, that it's on a boat. It's just, I'm trying to tell you to point out the outrageousness and the unprecedented nature of this kind of a scheme or plot. And I'd also like to bring up the idea that there's a certain faction within the Libertarian Party that wishes to exclude people they refer to as povertarians from attending conventions.
This is not policy, Mark.
Well, okay. I think that it needs to be brought up at some point. Maybe I can bring it up during my closing arguments.
All right.
If I'm allowed such a thing.
Okay. Well, against your closing argument, okay. One other question, so I can give other people a chance to ask other questions they may have. What in your mind is the, what do you believe, the theory that the defense has, that Dan has suggested, the reason for Bylaw 3 scope, if I'm interpreting what he's saying right, is that the reason for that bylaw is so that if the Libertarian Party of California does some political activity in another state or does something somewhere nationally, that it is not, for instance, if we have a convention in Las Vegas, that we're not conflicting with something that the Las Vegas LP or the LP of Nevada is doing and confounding their plans. So the reason for having that there is to check with them so that we're not, we're not working at cross purposes. Do you accept that as the rationale for Bylaw 3?
No, I don't. I just have to say, no, I do not. In fact, I don't think that anyone looking at that bylaw, and I've circulated this bylaw amongst many, many people, I don't think that anyone would reasonably think that it refers to that at all, because it doesn't talk about that. It doesn't say that. And again, why when you're talking, when you have a document, except for one section, that mainly deals with the activities of the officers and the executive committee, why suddenly would you start talking about something like that without clearly stating it? Because you're going outside what is the general focus of the entire bylaws. So if you're going to go off on a tangent like that, one would think that it would be explicitly stated, and it is not. I would say that it could be a possibility that could be part of its interpretation. No, I would have to say that I do not think that should be part of the interpretation, because again, there's nothing that implies it. You know, because you're talking about a document that's talking about, you know, what we're doing in California and what applies to, you know, our meetings and how our meetings are conducted and where they're conducted and why they're conducted and under what rules they're conducted. Then suddenly to go off on a tangent like that, and for it to mean that, I think it would have to be more explicitly stated inside of the document itself. It would be like, you know, the saying that in the Constitution, where it says that, we the people, or that promoting the general welfare means the government can then do whatever it wants. You know, as Madison said, why would you have a document stating what the government can and cannot do, and then put a sentence in there saying that the government can do whatever it wants? You have to talk about the consistent, what is the document consistently talking about, and it's not talking about those things, and it's not explicitly stated. So I would have to say it would be taking that bylaw out of context of the rest of the document in order for it to mean that.
Okay. Let's go around one more time. One question apiece. Gail?
Earlier when I said it was 89 and 88,
I
was wrong. It's 1991 and 1990 that the section, Title VI, Section 3 came in 1991, long after Las Vegas.
Gail, I cannot hear anything saying.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Rodney?
Earlier, yeah. I said the bylaw 6, Section 3, came in 89. It came in 1991.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing anything.
Oh, yeah. I'll just repeat what Gail said. This is Bob. Is that okay with everybody?
Is it possible that she could talk directly into the mic instead of on a speakerphone, if that's what's happening?
I'll just repeat.
Go ahead.
Rodney?
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just repeat what Gail said.
Okay.
What she was saying was that Bylaw 6, Section 3,
uh-huh,
was not passed. Bylaw 6, Section 3 was not passed until 1991. But am I looking at the right? I'm looking at the PDF of our bylaws, and Bylaw 6, Section 3 refers to maintenance of the State Central Committee membership database.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the 1991 bylaws, which is the first copy of the bylaws where the section on county is deemed as having elective offices.
No, that's in a different section of the bylaws.
Yeah, because they've been reordered since then.
Right.
So, but the first time it appears is in 1991.
It's currently... sorry for interrupting, but it's currently Bylaw 8, Section 4.
Okay.
Which refers to county is deemed as having selected its officers, et cetera, only if election membership has been mailed to the members 30 days, but no more than 60 days in advance of the election, et cetera.
Well, that is something that was placed in, I believe, in 91. I'm not
right.
Sure it was in and that wasn't it wasn't part of the bylaws. Again, this thing stipulating mainly inside of California was not was not present when we had the convention in Vegas. And also the Vegas thing is entirely different. Can of worms, because you don't have to leave the United States to go there. You don't have to arrive a certain time in order to go there or stay after a certain amount of time. You can get on a bus or a train or a plane or a car and just go there anytime you want.
This
Las
one's
Vegas.
Coming and going at will.
Yes, and certainly on a boat you cannot.
The convention is the State Central Committee. In between, there's no State Central Committee. There's only an Executive Committee.
Mm-hmm. An Executive Committee of the State Central Committee.
Yeah. The State Central Committee only exists while it's in convention, and it's the only meeting they have.
Yep. So
okay.
Definitely, that would have to do with primarily inside the state of California, and it applies.
Okay, is that your question, Gail, or?
No.
Oh.
No.
Okay, did you have a question?
Just clarifying.
Oh. Did you,
that
what?
Mark is talking about people being able to come and go at will, which they can do on land.
Right.
And that people can come at whatever cost. You mean you can find all kinds of alternative transportation and alternative lodging and other than buying a package deal.
Right.
So what he's saying is this is a package deal, that you have to go from beginning to end and pay the top dollar cost. Not the top dollar, but
right.
To what anybody has paid in the past as a top dollar cost.
Right.
So
and that's,
I think I'm clear on that.
And that's opposing an additional restriction that we, as an executive committee under the bylaws, do not have the power to do. And we can only do the things that the bylaws say we can do, just like the Constitution.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Gail. Mark?
So, a closing statement?
I
think you meant the other
Mark.
Mark
Ankle?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, too bad we don't have Mark Murphy online, too. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Or Mark.
Mark.
Right.
Mark Giroff. yeah, very common name. Hildenberger. My dad was going to name me Wolfgang. It probably would have been much better. My mom would have let him know.
Go ahead.
I'm in German name.
Okay, so part of the supporting documentation that was sent around, I'm not sure who sent this, but I do remember a while back, in fact, looks like 1989, March Fong Yu versus the San Francisco Democratic Committee. This is where basically the U.S. Supreme Court held that the state law does not have the right to basically interfere with the inner workings of the party. So I just wanted to direct sort of everybody's attention to that.
Would you like me to answer that? Is that a question you'd like me to answer?
Well,
I've already answered it, but I'll
okay,
name it. According to that, we haven't made any kind of a ruling anywhere at any time, disassociating ourselves with the peace and freedom rules. I think that it doesn't really. I'm not really talking about what the state has done. I mean, I do think that it still could apply, but in certain cases,
I'll direct you to Bylaw 25,
which is what
it has to do with a. Let me get to it here. Conflicting authority. Yeah, conflicting authority is the statement. Let's see. In the event of any conflict between these bylaws and the California Election Code, Federal Election Code, or any other law or regulation, these bylaws shall govern the party and its affairs.
Right. Okay. But we still have adopted the... what was that, Gail?
Nothing. Sorry, I was talking to Ed.
We still, I mean, we exist because of those, the peace and freedom laws, and we haven't really, the piece, when that was passed, we could then exist. And we've always used them, and they've always governed our affairs. And we've always used them when we talk to the state to justify our existence and also to say that the signature requirements signatures in lieu of filing, I mean, are part of that, are part of the peace and freedom law. So we do use them. Also, the peace and freedom laws in the sections that I referred to are not in any way in conflict with our bylaws. In fact, our bylaws reinforce them. The bylaws of the counties reinforce them. Robert's Rules of Order reinforce them as well. All of these documents all say that this convention is not right. The county laws, the county rules, our own bylaws, Robert's Rules of Order, and state law all say that we can't have this convention. Common sense says we can't have this convention. Tradition says we can't have this convention. There's no inconsistency at all. And the bylaw you're citing does not in any way affect it because there's no inconsistency. All of them are consistent and work together.
Dark side.
I was looking at the convention contract and noting that it refers to having a provision for the contractor ensuring a convention hall that would accommodate 200 persons. And it occurred to me that, and I don't know if this has been brought up anywhere, but I don't recall seeing it brought up, but, you know, a ship can only accommodate a certain number of people, especially if people are required to have cabins on a ship. An argument could be made if they're not required to have separate cabins, if there's some sort of mass seating where people are allowed to sleep, you know, on the deck somewhere or something, that might not be an issue. But it seems to me that there is a potential issue with simply people, potentially not being able to go if too many people expect an interest in this convention. And, it's filled up. I mean, even potentially officers of the Libertarian Party of California could be prevented from going if they didn't get their registration in time and thus would not be able to attend the convention and fulfill their duties under the bylaws. I guess this is more of a statement than a question, but do you have any comment on that or any further insights?
Yeah, I mean, if an officer of the party, if the chair of the California Libertarian Party gets a flat tire on the way to the boat, the boat's going to leave, and we may not have officers, people will miss. I mean, again, it's just all of this stuff contributes to the overall outrageousness of this proposed convention. Before every convention, even before I was on the executive committee in California, I saw the places that we were going to have the convention at. I was able to look at it, members were able to look at it. It was proposed to us, and we saw it. And I do not know if this boat can accommodate that many people. I do not know how many people are going to be there. And there's every time somebody opens their mouth, I hear another potential problem with this convention and its idea, and it just is impractical.
Well, I'm sorry, Margaret, you made those points. I just want to try to stick as much as possible to the legal stuff. But do you have any...
We're just about out of time. I want to allow Bob to ask one more question if he...
Okay.
I don't have any more questions, actually.
Let me clarify
on that last point then, briefly.
Go ahead. Quickly.
Mark, do you know of any specific requirements that dictate allowing anyone who meets the criteria to be able to attend the convention?
Criteria of what?
Like
bylaws?
Yeah. Or the officers must be able to, not be prohibited from attending the convention.
I do not know of anything in our bylaws that say that, but the delegates, it needs to be reasonably accessible. It needs to be held in a central location, and also it needs to be... you cannot impose fees beyond the membership fee. And there's, because there's nothing that is, there's nothing that's stated in the bylaws that says you can charge an additional fee, so therefore you can't.
I understand that. I was asking you if you had any specific other information regarding that at this point. But
I don't, there may be, but I do not have it at this point.
Okay. As far as this section of the conference, your testimony has ended. We are through with you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You know, and I am not going to listen to the rest of this, the rest of this stuff, but because I've done the best that I can, and listening to you is going to help. And I'd just like to thank all the members. I'd like to thank all the members of the Judicial Committee for considering my point of view and for being here today. And I'll see you all at the convention, no matter where it is. Even if we held it on a UFO in outer space.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for appearing.
Bye-bye.
My atomic clock says 8:16. Let's take a 10. And when I say 10, that means 10 minute break till 8:26. At 8:26, we'll say 8:27 now. At 8:27, we will start with Dan's testimony. Sharp. Okay.
Okay. We can just. We don't have to. We can just. We don't have to hang up or anything.
No. No. Don't, please don't hang up.
Okay. So we don't have to dial in again. All right. Thank you.
I would actually. I think I'm going to hang up and then let my phone recharge a little bit here, and I'll come back in.
Okay. See
you.
Okay.
Okay. Talk to you in 10 minutes. All right.
Okay.
Some music interlude.
counsel back?
I never left, but I don't think Rondi's back yet.
Well, I've just been in the kitchen, stuffing my face, fixing in a snack. Who am I talking to?
Gail, this is Dan.
Hi, Dan. I guess some people were going to call back in.
Yeah, well, there's still 9 minutes and 28 seconds left. I mean, 1 minute, we've only used up 9 minutes and 28 seconds. So.
According to my atomic clock, it's now 8:26.
Yeah, that's what I have on my number.
Well, I'm using my watch, which is the standard for all time in the universe. All right.
Right, because you're the universe, right?
Well, it's the Elder Statesman's watch.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I couldn't think of the right word. Well, if my clock is red, white, and blue, does that count?
It counts a little bit. You know, I'll give you 2 points.
Okay. I was using the computer. AOL time.
Hi, this is Skycap. Okay,
nice.
Star Child here, and I think I heard Mark Hinkle and Gail Lightfoot, correct?
Mm-hmm. I'm here, Gail.
Great. And Mark is here, I think. Hinkle?
Yes.
And Bob is here?
Present.
And Dan?
Yes.
All right. Terrific. The same rules for this teleconference applies to the previous one, and again, I would suggest that everyone else, other than the people whose name I called, mute their phones by pressing *6 to reduce the background noises. Dan, we'll give you 10 minutes unimpeded to make your arguments, and then we'll start firing questions after that.
Okay. First of all, let me make sure. Has everybody on the Judicial Committee received the written arguments that I emailed out yesterday? Yes, I have. This is Bob.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, good. I'll try to keep my opening remarks brief because I did go into considerable detail in those written arguments to try to refute Mr. Seltzer's contentions. I also accumulated here a long list of items which I, after listening to Mark, that I would like to rebut, but there's certainly not going to be time during my opening 10 minutes, so I think I'm going to have to get to most of those items later on in the course of the questioning. I think that the crux of this whole matter lies in Bylaw 17, Section 2. And let me just quote it because I think it's the governing bylaw. Quote, "It shall be the responsibility of the Executive Committee to set the time, place, and schedule of events for the convention of delegates to the annual meeting of the State Central Committee. At least 120 days' notice must be provided to the membership concerning these arrangements," unquote. And really, I think this says it all. Determining the location of the state convention is left solely to the discretion of the Executive Committee. Unless there is a direct contradiction with some other provision of the bylaws, this bylaw is the controlling provision regarding the selection of the convention location. Robert's rules don't really even come into play in this matter, because this matter is, quote, specifically covered, unquote, by Bylaw 17, Section 2. But in any case, I believe that the actions of the Executive Committee are consistent with Robert's Rules of Order. The Executive Committee voted by more than a three-quarters majority to hold the State Convention on board the Royal Caribbean's Monarch of the Seas cruise ship from February 24th to 27th of next year. It was the second vote to approve in principle a contract with Continuing Education Incorporated to obtain some guaranteed low fares for delegates. But I think it's important to note that the decision to hold the convention on a cruise ship does not depend on the approval of any contract. Those were two separate votes. Mr. Seltzer's objections especially seem to focus on a couple of items. The first is Bylaw 3, which states, quote, the party shall conduct its activities primarily within the state of California. Any party activities taking place outside of California must be coordinated with and approved by the state or national Libertarian Party organizations having jurisdiction over the areas affected, unquote. Now, Mr. Seltzer claims that this means the LPC can't conduct any activities on the high seas or in Mexico because there isn't already a Libertarian Party organization there. This is an absurd and illogical reading of this provision. Bylaw 3 does not prohibit the LPC from engaging in activities outside of California where there are no existing LP organizations. Bylaw 3 does prohibit the LPC from engaging in activities outside of California where there are existing LP organizations having jurisdiction there unless we first coordinate with them and get their consent. I consulted with a legal expert, Ed Clark, regarding the proper interpretation of Bylaw 3. You all know Ed. You know he's an extremely fair-minded and honest individual as well as an excellent attorney. This is his area of expertise. As head of Atlantic Richfield's antitrust legal division, he has spent many years grappling with government regulations which were often confused or ambiguous or contradictory, as well as with private contracts which contained many complex requirements. So he knows what he's doing here. And when I talked to Ed, his immediate reaction after I explained the issue to him and read him the text of Bylaw 3 was pretty much the same as mine. But of course, it referred to areas where there already were LP organizations having jurisdiction, and that it in no way restricted the LPC in areas where existing LP organizations did not have jurisdiction. But Ed went ahead and asked me to send him the exact text of Bylaw 3, and he said he'd study it further. Later, Ed emailed me the following legal opinion, which I will quote. Quote, a common legal tool of analysis of the meaning of constitutions, bylaws, and other documents is to try to determine the intent of the body or person that wrote the document. It seems clear to me, and I think it would be clear to most readers of Bylaw 3, that the intent was to avoid conflict with and promote harmony among the various Libertarian parties by requiring the California Party to coordinate with and get the approval of other Libertarian parties before conducting activities in areas falling under the jurisdiction of other parties. I think it highly unlikely that the LPC intended to control activities on a cruise ship, on a spaceship on the way to the moon, or in any other place over which no other Libertarian Party claimed jurisdiction. Since there appears to be no possibility that other Libertarian parties would claim jurisdiction over a convention conducted during a California Ensenada cruise, it is unlikely that the LPC, in adopting this bylaw, intended to restrict the power of the LPC to conduct such a cruise. To decide that Bylaw 3 prohibits such an activity would thus be contrary to the intent of the party in adopting it and would prohibit an activity that the LPC may decide is in the best interest of the party and libertarianism, unquote. The second issue which Mr. Seltzer focuses on is the cost and the physical limitations of the convention at sea. He claims that having a convention on a cruise ship constitutes illegal restrictions on delegates, even though the bylaws say nothing about convention costs or locations, instead leaving that up to the executive committee. Every California convention imposes significant costs, both in time and money, on many of the delegates. There are travel costs and hotel costs and meals and convention packages. None of these constitute a violation of the bylaws. Every year there will be some members who can't afford to become delegates and attend a convention or can't find the time. Counties normally take that into account when selecting their delegates to the convention. So if one person can't make it, a county attempts to find someone else to serve as a delegate. The executive committee's purpose in approving a convention on a cruise ship was not to limit attendance, it was to increase attendance. We believe that by putting on something different, something unique and exciting, we will attract people who are tired of the same old formula every year. We think that smaller counties, which rarely if ever send anyone to a convention, will be encouraged to find delegates for a cruise ship, and that larger counties will have a much better chance of filling out their delegations. Now, you know, maybe we're wrong, maybe we're right, time will soon tell. But the executive committee made a judgment call. It thought that the downside risk was low and the upside potential was very high. Mr. Seltzer obviously thinks it was a bad decision, but he lost the vote. Perhaps some members of this judicial committee agree with Mr. Seltzer that the executive committee made a wrong choice, but that isn't the issue before the judicial committee. The issue before the judicial committee is whether the executive committee acted in accordance with the bylaws. And I don't think there can be any doubt that the executive committee's actions were indeed consistent with the bylaws and precisely fulfilled the mandate of Bylaw 17, Section 2. Rodney, how much time do I have left?
About a minute and a half.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I'm not going to be able right now to get to some of my notes here on Mark's other comments, but let me at least mention the issue of the California State Elections Code. I've already sent you some written arguments regarding that, but I think it's very clear that this is not even something that should be an issue here. The state party is governed by our bylaws, not the elections code. We have a bylaw that specifically says that in case there's any conflict, the bylaws will take precedence. And the items that Mark has attempted to cite in his email from the elections code, not only has he misquoted things, but they're not even relevant. In many cases, they're from completely different portions of the elections code which don't apply to the Libertarian Party. The fact is that the 1989 U.S. Supreme Court decision, U versus San Francisco Democratic Committee, makes very clear that the Secretary of State cannot interfere in the internal governance of state political parties. And anything else is a violation of our associational rights. The language in that decision, I think, is just great. I like to keep reading it over because it's so clear. The Supreme Court is saying that the Secretary of State cannot interfere, even if the Secretary of State thinks that this would increase democracy within the political party, that it's not up to the Secretary of State to try to protect the party against itself or to reduce frictions or anything else, that a party can make its own rules. And we've done so. There are peace and freedom rules that say you have to have a 50-50 gender split in representation and so on, that you have to alternate between northern and southern, various other things, which we absolutely do not do, and that is because our bylaws supersede that, and those regulations are unconstitutional in any case. So I don't think that that should be an issue at all here. I think with that, I will stop, and I will let you ask whatever questions you can, and as I say, I'll try to get some of the other items in the course of those questions.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Gail.
I don't have any specific questions, but I did want to ask Dan, do you realize that the sections in that lawsuit in that ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court that all those sections have been removed from the election code and that what's left we can assume are applicable?
No, they have not. They have not.
Here. My copy, which is 2004.
I've gone to their website and those sections are still there. They just are not enforced.
Well, like I said, my printed copy, they're not present.
Well, that may be. All I know is what I saw at their website.
I looked for the parties and read through that, but the sections numbered, as they're numbered in that lawsuit, I looked quickly in my book here and they don't appear.
Oh, well, section numbers may have changed since then, but if you look in the on the website of the Secretary of State's office under Elections Code or under the California website under Elections Code, all of those illegal things are still there. They may have changed section numbers, but they're there and they're unenforceable.
All right.
Okay. Mark Hinkle.
No questions at this point, but I'm going to think of some.
All right.
Can I feed you some, Mark? You know, you can ask me.
So that would be,
And actually, I think it was Rodney that several folks made reference to the bylaws, and I think I know Mark brought up several reasons why it might not be a good idea, but I think it is our job to focus on whether there's been a violation of the bylaws, not whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to hold a convention on the on a cruise ship. I don't really think that's germane. I think what we have to focus on is specific contentions that there was bylaws violations. And so that's my statement for the time being.
Okay. L'enfant l'étoile.
Is that me now?
Yeah.
Sorry, Charles. Yeah. Dan, one of the supporters of the XCOM's decision to hold the convention on the cruise ship, M. Carling, earlier raised a procedural issue about the Judicial Committee's process. Do you agree that the Judicial Committee has properly held this hearing, that it has full authority to hold this hearing, that this hearing is valid?
I think that I'm going to avoid that question. I want to focus on winning this on the merits, and I think that there are some questions that have been raised, but I hope that it will all be moot, and we need not waste any time on that.
In my opinion, it's a valid thing to bring up because I think it's important to know that the parties to the hearing are going to respect the results of the hearing and, not contest any results. If there's some indication that the results may be contested, then we could be wasting our time here.
You're asking me something that I have not really focused on. I've been busy looking at the specific arguments here, and I have not been focusing on M. Carling's procedural issues. So I really cannot answer that at the moment.
Okay. Next question I have is, would it be legal, in your opinion, under the LPC bylaws, if the LPC were to hypothetically charge a $2,000 fee in order to attend a convention of the delegates? Or whether it was just levied as a straight fee or whether it was to pay for the cost of where the convention was being held, if there are those cases, would you consider that legal in compliance with the bylaws?
I don't see anything in the bylaws that restricts the executive committee in that respect. I think that there are a lot of things that the executive committee could do that would frankly destroy the party if they did it, but would not violate the bylaws. There are obviously a lot of the party's success depends upon having at least semi-reasonable people acting as officers, acting as members, acting on the executive committee, and if the executive committee could set dues at $2,000 a year, and that would be legal, but it would destroy the party. So I think that while the power is there, it requires some reasonable discretion on the part of the executive committee if it expects to advance the purpose of the party.
Okay. In another section here of your response to Mark Seltzer, the most recent response, you mentioned the duty of delegates to attend business sessions and their obligation to attend the convention under Robert's Rules of Order. How would you respond to the point that if, say, the spaces on the cruise ship fill up, you know, someone who is a delegate and has gone through the proper procedures and everything to become a delegate could be prohibited from being able to attend the convention and fulfilling their obligation because there is no more space available?
I don't think that that's a practical issue. My understanding is that the cruise ship can carry like 3,000 people, and it's got room in one of its meeting halls for up to 1,000 people. And this is something that the cruise ships and organizations like Continuing Education Incorporated do all the time. They arrange for conventions, they arrange for continuing education courses, things like that, to try to attract large groups to a cruise ship, and their interest is not in conflict with ours. They want us to have a successful convention. They're going to they have the capacity, and they're going to make sure that we are able to have as many people as can attend the convention. I suspect that if we had 500 people attending, they could handle it. The only thing that might be affected is that some of the, if people wanted some desirable ocean view cabins, there might be a problem there.
Okay. One last brief question. When you say practical considerations, should make this, moot in this case, mentioned that, I'm sorry, just a moment here, I must move my place. I'll pass for now.
Okay, thank you. Bob?
Dan, the only question I have is, by requiring that the delegates, purchase a convention package, essentially, that you purchase passage on this ship. Could you address the question that you are imposing an additional requirement on delegates over and above what would just naturally occur from things like travel expenses or requirements that you have to you have to be domiciled somewhere during the convention?
Well, there's several things. First of all, in the first place, there's nothing in the bylaws which addresses this or says that you can't impose additional requirements, even if that were the case. This gets back, as far as I'm concerned, to the issue that you're always going to have cases where the cost of the convention or its location or its timing are going to make it difficult for some potential delegates. And not all members are delegates. Counties select people to be delegates, and if somebody says they can't make it or they can't afford it that year, then the county can select somebody else. I know that's what happens in my county, Ventura County. The first thing we do when we select delegates at our end of the year elections is we ask, who can make it? And somebody says, well, I can't this time, then we don't select a person as a delegate. I don't think that this is anything. Even if let me put it this way. The bylaws leave the decision to the executive committee under bylaw 17, section 2. But the Robert's Rules of Order anticipate the fact that there will be costs to delegates. And let me take this occasion to rebut one of the points that Mark attempted to make, namely the section in Robert's Rules on page 555, in which he quoted the sentence, "Members cannot be assessed any additional payment aside from their dues unless it is provided in the bylaws." This section is not relevant.
That's obviously members, not delegates.
I'm sorry. Members cannot be assessed any additional payment aside from their dues unless it is provided in the bylaws.
Right. I agree with you that the Roberts Rules in question refers to members of an organization, not delegates to a convention. So.
Right. Well, but it's not only that. Roberts Rules also refer to costs elsewhere. For example, on page 593 in the section on Convention Credentials Committee, it states that one of the steps normally included in registration is, quote, recording of the member as officially registered upon his paying the registration fee, which is sometimes set in advance, and signing the list of registrations, unquote. So there, Robert's Rules clearly anticipate that people might have to pay registration fees, and obviously this is not related to any additional assessment on members. In another section on page 588, Robert's Rules discusses the organization of a convention of an established society, and the following sentence appears, quote, "Most conventions must operate on a closely controlled schedule and transact a large amount of business quickly, often with rented facilities available only for a prearranged length of time, and with each added day of meetings entailing considerable expense both to the association and to the delegates personally," unquote. So again, Robert's Rules recognizes that there can be considerable expense, that's what it says, considerable expense for delegates personally. The fact that there are such expenses in no way conflicts with the bylaws or with Robert's Rules of Order. And if you think about it, you know, just look at our national conventions where very often people, you know, have to spend many hundreds of dollars or more to attend a convention in a distant state, stay for several days at a hotel room, meals, have to frequently buy convention packages, cost far more than the state convention. That's not considered a violation of any implied or explicit rules in the national bylaws. This is just the reality. You know, conventions cost money, and sometimes people can afford to go and sometimes they can't.
Dan, this is Mark Hinkle. If I recall, the last two state conventions had a registration fee. And if I also recall, the convention chose not to basically address that issue.
Well, as I recall, the last convention had a floor fee, and that got paid by someone, and so it never got to the Judicial Committee because it was a moot point.
Correct. Okay. But the convention as a whole did not address the issue.
That's right.
You know, they had the opportunity to do so. Hey, Bob?
Yeah?
Yes.
Any more questions? Or?
No, I don't have any more questions.
Okay. I want to go back to the cost also, Dan. Do you see a difference between, do you see a distinguishing difference between incidental costs and explicit costs that are imposed by the organization itself? For instance, differentiating the cost of traveling or hotels or food or even other non-business convention items versus a charge by the organization to be a delegate and participate in the business of the convention?
Well, if I'm understanding correctly, I think that there's a separate issue, which of course we're not trying to address here, regarding the whole question of floor fees, and I believe that that was a justifiable decision to have floor fees so that some people were not subsidizing the cost of the facilities for other people. But I think that what we have here is a package that that people are going to have to pay, which is substantially the same in many respects as the package that people would pay for a typical convention, if you include the a convention package, even not the most expensive convention package, and stay in a hotel or motel, and meals, whether included in the convention package or purchased separately. It's certainly the case that some people who might otherwise live near a convention and commute might be able to avoid some of the costs of a convention, and they won't be able to in this instance. But I don't see that as different in kind from the fact that somebody who has to go from Ventura to San Jose for a convention is going to have comparable or larger costs than they will have going on this cruise ship to Ensenada.
But again, what about the cost, the explicit cost of being that are imposed on a person who wants to be a delegate and wants to participate in this on the business of the convention?
We and others are trying to do a number of things to help people, you know, as far as the costs themselves, and I recognize that, as I say, for some people who might otherwise commute, there will be higher costs. But we are trying to do some things to address the cost issue, and let me just mention a few of them. First of all, just to start off with, my understanding is that we picked the least expensive weekend in terms of cruise fares. I also understand that some counties, such as San Bernardino County, are planning to provide financial assistance to the delegates from their county. A committee has been appointed consisting of Alan Hacker, Mark Seltzer, Paul Ireland, and Rick Nicole, that was appointed back in May, to raise money to aid delegates who need financial assistance to attend the convention.
And that's an LPC sponsor?
Yes, yes. Now, to my knowledge, this committee hasn't done much yet, but then, you know, we've only now arranged for the convention, so I hope that this committee will be much more active in the future. I know that there are people who the committee can ask for financial assistance who have not yet been asked. So I would expect that they will be able to raise some money. Last year, we were able to raise pledges of financial assistance for that convention, and most of that, my understanding is, went unused. Another thing that we're planning on doing is offering commissions equal to 10% of a convention package, which people can apply towards their own convention packages, so people can try to, for example, sign up five other people to convention cruise and thereby get 50% off their own package, or they can sign up 10 people and get 100% off, or sign up 15 people and get 100% off and donate the surplus to somebody else. So this is a way that somebody who might otherwise have a financial problem can try to go to a convention as well.
But if these measures fail to, let's say that these measures fail to bring in any money or sufficient money, will a delegate who does not come up with $170, or with enough money to get on the boat, excuse me, will they be denied entrance into, will they be able to participate in business on the convention floor?
Obviously not. They won't be on the boat, and the convention business is going to be taking place on the boat. But there's nothing in the bylaws which says that this can't be done, or that this is some kind of illegal restriction on delegates. The bylaws don't say anything about it, and Robert's rules, to the extent they say anything about it, recognize that there can be such additional expenses, that there can be registration fees, there can be substantial personal expenses to attending a convention. Again, not every member is automatically a delegate. Counties select delegates, and if somebody is not able to afford to go or doesn't have the time to go, that is not a violation of the bylaws. It means that the county needs to try to find somebody else to fill out its delegation.
Well, Section 4 of Bylaw 17 says every county shall, S-H-A-L, be entitled to send delegates to the convention according to the following credential. I read that to say if a county meets those credentials, or if a delegate is entitled to be a delegate, then that person shall be a delegate, and a delegate has, do all delegates have the right to, would you say that all delegates have the right to participate on the convention, in a convention business?
Not at somebody else's expense. Delegates have historically been expected to pay their own way to conventions. And
I can barely hear. I don't know if it's my phone or yours.
Is this any better?
It's
yours, Rodney, because we hear it damn just fine.
Maybe I'll go to another phone. Hold on just a second.
Okay.
Okay, talk.
Okay.
Well, that is better. Yeah. Okay. Just taking away from my computer. All right, go ahead.
Okay. Delegates do not have a right to attend the convention at other people's expense. And historically, delegates have always paid their own way to conventions. The fact that a delegate may not be able to afford it is not a violation of the bylaws. The executive committee, in deciding to have a convention on a cruise ship, or in San Diego, or Santa Maria, or Las Vegas, or up in the mountains, or whatever, is not violating anybody's rights, even if this causes financial difficulties or time difficulties for some potential delegates.
Okay, well, I probably have another couple of questions, but I think I'm going to go ahead and send it around to the group again. Gail?
Nothing here.
Okay. Mark?
Nothing here.
Okay. Starchild?
Yeah.
Dan, are you saying that you think there is no difference between a cost that a delegate has to pay in order to get to a convention, such as driving or flying or however they choose to get there, and a cost that is imposed by the nature of the particular convention fee or payment required to enter the building or the physical locale, such as a ship where the convention is taking place? It's your contention that those things are exactly the same for legal purposes?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by exactly the same for legal purposes, but I think that they are substantially the same as far as the fact that both are unavoidable costs that many delegates face, and if a delegate is not able to afford those costs, then they're not able to be a delegate at that particular convention.
Now, I would argue that they're not both unavoidable costs. Getting to the convention is an unavoidable cost because everyone lives in different locations, and so there's always going to be some expense, although in many cases somebody might be able to get a ride for free, and so they wouldn't necessarily pay that expense themselves, but there's always going to be some expense involved in reaching the location where a convention is going to take place. But there isn't necessarily any unavoidable cost that, is required to be borne by delegates. In fact, I would argue that there's a bylaw argument that delegates should not be required to pay any fee because, as Rodney was getting at, it says that anyone who meets these criteria shall be a delegate. I accept your point about Robert's Rules of Order allowing for certain fees, registration fees, but if something is not specified as being allowed by the bylaws, then, there's no grounds for those fees existing, so it wouldn't reach Robert's Rules of Order, is my contention.
Well, but the decision regarding the location of the convention and the conduct of the party's affairs is vested in the executive committee. And the executive committee has full authority to make those kinds of decisions, to weigh those issues, and it has done so.
Nobody's questioning that, but that doesn't give the executive committee the authority to violate the bylaws.
Well, it's not violating the bylaws, though.
That's your opinion. I mean, that's what we're debating here. That's what the hearing is about, right?
Yes, that's true. But I don't see how you can say that the fact that you agree there are going to be expenses for people, and we're talking about matters of degree here.
We're talking about two different kinds of expenses, and that's kind of the point that my question was getting at. You say that there's no substantial difference, but you seem to be indicating there is some difference in kind.
The bylaws don't differentiate between those kinds of expenses. The bylaws don't say that one kind of expense is illegal and another kind isn't. The bylaws simply give the executive committee the authority to decide the location and time of the convention, and everybody recognizes that there will always be expenses involved, and that it will differentially impact potential delegates. As I pointed out, we are trying to do things to help some delegates, recognizing that it's a good idea to help people who might need some financial assistance, and I think we'll be able to do that. But I don't see how you can read into the bylaws some requirement that there not be expenses to attend the convention.
But earlier to you, I just found the language here. It says Robert's Rules of Order, 10th edition, page 554. States that a member's right to vote cannot be suspended unless the bylaws so provide. And it further states that, quote, members cannot be assessed any additional payment aside from their dues unless it is provided for in the bylaws. And since there's no specific provision for any such additional payment in the bylaws,
I would argue that the Libertarian Party Executive Committee or its contractor does not have any authority to require any such additional dues now in the or fees. Now, in the case of the delegates attending the convention, it's not a requirement that the executive committee is imposing. It's simply a natural fact resulting from the fact that people have to travel in order to get somewhere.
Exactly. And this section that you referred to is talking about members. We're not doing anything about members. If you look through that section, it talks about, it's referring to the circumstances under which a member can become delinquent in their payment and might be dropped for non-payment of dues and so on. None of this applies to delegates. We're not dropping members from the party or anything else. We're not imposing additional dues on members. Members are not automatically delegates. Counties select delegates to go to the convention.
But a delegate must be a member, and if you're opposing...
A member is not necessarily a delegate.
This is true, but if you're imposing something on A, and A is part of automatically part of B, then you are imposing something on B.
Yeah.
So you are imposing something on members,
Something
on delegates.
That transitive logic is not correct.
when you impose something on delegates, you are imposing something on people who are members.
That's true. But the restriction you're talking about refers to members, not delegates. And the restriction, because something from delegates applies to members, it's not commutative. The Boolean logic is not commutative.
We don't follow Dan.
All right. Bob.
Yes. I have no questions.
Okay. Let me ask this, Daniel. You talked about... Let's see. You talked about, you said that it was possible. You talked about the idea of delegates potentially being able to get to the convention by busing from Tijuana to Ensenada, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, it's the reverse. It turns out that the business session is going to be held on Saturday and will be in Ensenada on Sunday. So the situation is that a person could attend the business session on Saturday and then Sunday morning, early in the morning, they could, if they wanted to, leave the cruise ship and take a bus home.
Oh. So you're not talking about
How do you get on the cruise ship for the Saturday session?
You're going to have to go Friday night, because this cruise ship is going to be at sea from the time it leaves the dock, and it's going to be at sea during the entire Saturday session. So unless you have a helicopter, which is possible, I suppose, you're going to have to get on Friday night.
Oh, okay. All right.
But the cruise ship doesn't have partial... you can't take a partial cruise on a cruise ship. If you leave early, you forfeit the other day.
What?
Yeah.
It costs the other day, correct?
That's true, but if you absolutely had to get back early, you could do so.
I guess, Dan, you can probably tell that I'm a little concerned about Section 4 and
which bylaw?
Bylaw 17, Section 4. It seems that defines the requirements for a county, a person to be a delegate, Am I reading that wrong, or?
Yeah, I think you are, Rodney. What it's saying is that it's an entitlement for the counties that they can have up to a certain number of delegates, they can send that money. Many, it doesn't say they have to send that money. Many, or that those people will all attend, and in many cases they don't. But they have the right to send that many delegates. That's all that it says.
Well, if I can interject, Buddy, may I?
No, go ahead.
This is Star Job. It says that people who meet these criteria shall be delegates, the criteria set forth in Section 4 of the bylaws.
Oh, I'm sorry, where are you reading?
Bylaw
17, bylaw 17,
Section
4.
Section 4.
Section 4. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. That's not the right section. Hang on here.
Oh, you're not talking about 17.4.
Just a minute. 17.4. No, that's... Wait a minute. Yeah, go ahead while I find what I'm looking for.
Well, let me also ask you... let me just ask this while you're looking, Sasha. Going back to 17.2... the responsibility of the executive committee to set the time, place, and schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say anything about cost there, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so, excuse me. So, if it said cost, I certainly would say that there is no discussion.
If it doesn't say something, first of all, the cost of the convention flows the location that has been selected. But again, if something isn't stated in the bylaws, you would go to Robert's Rules of Order, which does acknowledge the possibility of registration fees and considerable personal costs for delegates.
For members.
No, for delegates. No, that's two different sections. Maybe I wasn't clear on that. The section that was brought up regarding members cannot be assessed any additional payment aside from their duties unless it's provided in the bylaws, that's a different section, and that's not relevant because we're talking about delegates.
Okay, so...
What I'm talking about is on page 593.
Uh-huh.
In the section on the Convention Credentials Committee, it lists some of the things that are normally included in registration, and one of those items is, quote, recording of the member as officially registered upon his paying the registration fee, which is sometimes sent in advance, and signing the list of registrations, unquote. So there...
Dan?
Yes?
Do you know whether it says anywhere else in Robert's Rules of Order whether a registration fee would need to be mentioned in the bylaws in order to be valid?
No. There's in their recommended bylaws, they do not include anything to that effect. These are issues that are normally decided by an executive committee or governing body. This happens in all kinds of organizations, that they'll have registration fees or you'll have to buy a package to attend a convention. That's not in their bylaws, and that's not, and to the extent Robert's rule says anything,
well,
it acknowledges that they can do so.
The question is making it a condition of voting. That's where the problem comes in. I don't argue with the executive committee's authority to hold a convention where you pay a registration to hear speakers or to engage in other actions of the convention, but to require it as a condition of voting, of being a delegate, and interfering with the duty and obligation, as you put it, of delegates to attend convention and citing another section of Robert's Rules of Order, I don't
see any authority in the LPC bylaws to require that.
The condition for voting is that you have to be present on the floor at the convention. And and the executive committee has set the location for the convention, and you have to be there in order to be able to vote. The executive committee has the authority to do that. If there are costs involved,
in a way that it makes it impossible for people to get there.
Well, but we're not making it impossible. There are costs involved, just like there are costs for someone who has to travel from Siskiyou down to San Diego. And
so
for some
theoretically, there was no you know, practical problem with accommodating the number of people on a cruise ship, but it is entirely different from a hotel because, you know, basically anybody can come into a hotel and if push comes to shove, you can move the proceedings outside if you really have that many people. But on a cruise ship, that's not an option. You know, there's a limited number of people that are going to let on the ship.
You can come up with all kinds of extreme improbable problems. You could have a hurricane come along that would mess up the cruise ship. I mean,
that existing condition. It's not something that you know. I mean, the question isn't how likely it is. The question is, you know, is there guaranteed access for people? I see it as, you know.
Well, we have made arrangements to hold this on a large enough cruise ship that there should be no problem with as many people attending as can possibly come. We are hoping that we get 500 people, that we get 800 people. We can certainly accommodate any number we are likely to get. And this, again, is, you know, the bylaws don't make distinctions like that. These are the details that are left up to the governing body of the organization, in this case, the executive committee.
Well, you're
making the case that in order for a fee to be charged to attend a convention, a floor fee or whatever, that has to explicitly be mentioned in the bylaws. Is that correct?
Yes, because the existing language in the bylaws says that someone shall be a delegate who meets a certain criteria, and that is not listed among the criteria. If that clause wasn't in there, then I could see more of an argument that it didn't.
What clause are you referring to again there?
I think it is section 4. I was not being it quick the first time, but says, in addition to the foregoing, each holder of an elected public office is registered to vote as a libertarian, each chair of a county central committee, or a person appointed by the chair of that central county central committee who is otherwise qualified as a delegate under Rule 3, and each member of the party executive committee at the time the convention is held shall be a delegate from his or her respective. Actually, there's another section that says, that's here. There's another section that says basically everyone, because this came up last year. We went through this whole thing about the floor fee. And there's a section in here somewhere, maybe someone can find it for me, that says, you know, people meeting such and such a criteria shall be delegates. And it sets forth the particular criteria. And I don't see any real argument that, you know, additional criteria can be unilaterally imposed by XCOM or any other LPC body, which are not in the bylaws.
There are minimum criteria for membership and for delegates that are listed in the bylaws. I know where, you know, where you're analogizing from, that the U.S. Supreme Court has basically said that the only the criteria listed in the U.S. Constitution are the only ones that apply for Congress or President or whatever, and it invalidated term limit restrictions based on that, which I think was a very bad decision, and not something that that states do in many cases, but that is not something that applies to our bylaws, that occurs in Robert's Rules of Order.
Well, I
think the general libertarian interpretation of the Constitution is that, you know, if it's not in there, the government can't do it. I mean, we might agree that, you know, term limits are a good thing, but, you know, arguably, you know, if they aren't mentioned in there, then there is a strong argument that they're unconstitutional, I would say.
Well, we're a private organization.
Okay, that's not what the Constitution says. It says powers not enumerated here are reserved to the states or to the people.
Right.
So when you talk about government, you can't uniformly apply it state, local, and federal and say it's all the same, because it isn't.
Right. I thought Dan was referring to the federal constitution.
Right. But
yeah.
Just because the federal constitution says you can't do X, doesn't mean the states can't.
Well, that's true, yeah. I wasn't thinking that was his argument.
I think we're getting
Let me ask, there any other questions from anyone else? Either Gail or Mark or Bob?
Not for me, this is Bob.
Mark?
Nope.
Gail?
No.
Okay, well, we have about 2 minutes left. I guess, Star Child, if you have any questions, you can take the last 2 minutes.
Are we going to get Dan a closing?
Excuse me?
It's going, you know, over the same kind of stuff here. We have examined this pretty exhaustively, I think, but, you know, I'm sympathetic to Dan's arguments on the location of the convention. I don't really see Mark Seltzer's having made a good case that the party would be prohibited. You know, I think the difference between primarily and exclusively is a valid point that, you know, the party doesn't have to exclusively conduct its business within California, and the thing about no controlling authority in the seas is persuasive to me. I would agree with Ed Clark's analysis that, you know, that section of the bylaws was meant to preclude the party from engaging in libertarian activities that would conflict with the jurisdiction of another libertarian party that exists. For me, it boils down to a question of access, and I'm not satisfied that the bylaws criteria for delegates having access without being charged or otherwise had additional requirements imposed on them besides the natural requirements which accrue from, you know, going anywhere. You know, I'm not convinced that criteria has been met by this convention.
Well, you know, obviously you have to make your own judgments, but I think that I would say that the overwhelming preponderance of evidence and historical precedents and a reasonable reading of the bylaws and Robert's rules all argue that the executive committee has the right to make the kind of decision it did. It's a judgment call. It is, I think, a reasonable thing that the executive committee has done, and the attempt to overturn it is really reaching to try to find you know, a technicality which I don't agree with.
Well, you know, the same issue of access came up last year. It's not like something that Mark just pulled out of his hat. I mean, this has been an issue before, and you know, I think there's precedent both ways in terms of you know, what people have felt was authorized or not authorized in the past. So,
but I don't think this is
a characterization.
This is something that you know, we are trying to you know, to the extent that some people might have some financial problems, we are trying to find ways to address that. And beyond that, you know, this isn't a perfect world, but the executive committee thinks that this is the best way to increase attendance at the convention, that it's likely to encourage counties to send more people to the convention, and that it's worth an experiment. And
let me ask Mark, if I can interject. What Rather, in your opinion, would it be possible for the, or legal, I should say, under the bylaws and other rules, for the executive committee to offer to basically tell delegates, you can come, you know, we'll cover the cost of anyone who wants to come who is publicly credentialed as a delegate, but we ask you to donate money to cover your costs because realistically we can't afford to pay for everyone. Would that be legal?
Who are you asking?
I'm asking you.
Oh, I thought you said Mark.
I'm asking you the same question that I asked Mark.
I understand. I'm sorry. I'm waiting for Mark Hinkle to answer you, and I'm going,
I just lost the phone.
Okay. I don't think that's something that you can require the executive committee to do. I think that the you can certainly urge the executive committee to take actions to make it possible for as many people as possible to attend, regardless of financial issues. But obviously, the executive committee cannot commit to paying for everybody. And, this is something that basically has to be left up to the counties. They're the ones to select their delegates. Some counties are going to be providing financial assistance to their delegates. They're the ones that have to determine whether that is going to be necessary to fill out their delegations as much as possible.
Okay. So you're saying you don't think there's legal authority to require it, but there'd be nothing legally preventing the LPC XCOM from taking such a step if it were a question of either doing it that way or not having this convention?
I don't think that I don't think that you can require that as a condition of having the convention. I don't think you can bargain like that. You can't say, we'll approve this convention if the executive committee does that.
I'm not saying either.
Okay, well then what are you saying?
Rodney, can I interpret for Star Child here?
Go ahead.
I think what Star Child was asking is if the executive committee was entitled to ask for donations, which it seems to me that of course they are.
Yes, of course they are.
Star Child, was that your question?
Basically, my question is, you know, under these circumstances, given that there is a contract with an outside entity, are they able to basically pay the fee themselves rather than having other people, individual people, pay it, and then that they solicit themselves that payment?
Is the party capable of paying for every delegate?
Not are they capable of paying for every delegate. Are they legally able to take that position?
You mean?
Either by our bylaws or by...
You mean, would they be, would under the bylaws, would they be legally able to pay for every delegate?
Under the bylaws and under the contract with the convention contractor.
Why do you ask this question?
Well, you know, we're looking for solutions here.
We're not looking for policy solutions.
You can
go ahead and recommend some, but that's not what the judicial committee is doing.
The judicial committee does is judicial committee doesn't set policy.
Well, once we've made a decision, then we can talk about this if you'd like.
Right. I'm just trying to. Well, okay. Yeah. You have a point.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Okay.
Was that the voice I just heard?
No, that was me. I just wanted to quickly point out a couple of other things that Mark had brought up. There is, in fact, no BICRA problem with out-of-country fundraising activities, and I understand that this is something that's already been checked on. You know, as long as somebody is not a non-U.S. citizen, there's no problem with their donating money, even if they're not in the country. And, well, there are some other things here, but I think that those are side issues that probably aren't worth further comment.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Dan, very much for appearing, and we will have a decision. We should have a decision within 10 days for you and for Mark and the rest of everybody.
10 days?
Excuse me?
10 days?
I believe that's the requirement. Am I wrong about that?
2 days.
1 day.
Just looking it up, it says 2 days.
Let's see what they...
Oh, well, maybe we have to...
We have to render a decision within 2 days of the conclusion of the hearing. Yeah, I'm
okay,
just
wasn't there
up
a 10...
because I didn't remember.
Okay, I thought there was a 10-day thing. Maybe that's for written opinions or something. Okay, maybe.
That was enough to schedule the hearing.
Okay.
Section 8 under Judicial Committee.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dan, and I'd like for the JC members to stay on the line just for a few minutes while we decide what we need to do about our 2-day decision here. And but essentially, this hearing is over, and thank you for appearing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
I don't know... If other people who are listening are still here, but if anyone, you know, who has been listening all this time has anything they'd like to add, I think it would be great to hear from other people since they've been so quiet and patient this whole time.
Well,
I mean, not that it's part of the formal hearing, but just, you know, some of the people submitting
amicus briefs. Through a reasonable period of time, I've got no objections.
If it's an argument, and particularly a new argument, and not policy, I'm not interested. This is not a town hall meeting.
Right, right.
Okay. Anybody out there that has an opinion they want to express?
Yeah, Ronnie, this is Mike Seabeck talking.
Okay.
I just want to make one simple point, and I'm going to get off because I got to go eat dinner. There was a lot of conversation back and forth about whether the Robert's Rules allow for fees. But the difference here is what Robert's Rules accommodates and what the bylaws that specifically state can and can't be done. And I think that I would like the Judicial Committee to keep that difference in mind when they're deliberating this, that the ability to do something doesn't necessarily mean that you have the capability is one thing, but the right or the explicit power to do it are two different things. The Robert's Rules accommodate the fees, but there's nothing in the bylaw that says that they can be assessed. If the bylaw said they could be assessed, then the accommodations are covered in Robert's Rules. But because they're not addressed in the bylaws, that section of Robert's Rules is basically irrelevant.
Okay, so but I would ask you then, if that's the case, if the bylaws says nothing,
yes,
and Roberts is not applicable, then what would then make fees unconstitutional?
The fact that there is no reference to them in the first place. The silence does not indicate assent in this issue.
But I don't believe the bylaws has a 10th Amendment. There's no 10th Amendment clause in the bylaws. There's no enumerated powers clause in the bylaws.
That is correct, but I would also point out that there was a 1985 Supreme Court ruling, 85 I might add, that from Connecticut that Republicans brought forth, where the court ruled specifically, and this applies to political parties in general, that if there's a state law on the issue, but not a party bylaw on the issue, state law rules, and that if there is a state law and a party bylaw, the party bylaw rules. But the lack of either one did not give a sense to do this. And then that predates 89 one that was brought up several times. My point again, and this is coming from a guy that's system engineering for a living, is that there is a clear distinction between what can be accommodated and what's actually done. And all I'm saying is that I hope that you guys consider that.
Somebody else had a question there on the committee. Was somebody on the committee about to speak up or ask a question of Mike?
This is Dan. I was about to say something, but I bit my tongue.
Did it hurt?
Did you have a comment?
I don't want to get into arguments with other people who wish to comment. I let them say